So good morning. It's Friday, the 30th of November, if you're interested in that. It's funny, after a while, like my dates and times, that seem quite as meaningful when you need to set your clock and your day. So so day two. So we've been sitting for getting on to 2 days now, and I think over this time the mind starts to settle a bit, and around about day two you've kind of got, you're aware of the form and the structure and how the schedule goes and how long the sitting periods are, when the food comes, when the work starts. And so it gives the body an opportunity to, and the mind a chance to relax a little bit. Because when we come into a new environment, your kind of radar is on as to how am I going to be safe, what I need to do to get fed, how much sleep am I going to get, where's the toilet, all these kind of things. So over time, we kind of get comfortable, and I think so Sesshin is set up to do that, to allow ourselves to settle into a kind of a regular form, and then then we can start to do our work. And I always remember sitting at Zen Mountain Center when you were sitting in the Zendo at night, and you'd hear the mountain lion screaming in the canyon, and there's that sense that that's why you needed a hall, to get the mountain lions out so you could comfortably sit without being eaten, which is a good thing. But there's always getting back to your cabin, which was could be challenging in the dark. Some of us could do very good imitations of mountain lion calls as well. So for the new people, the dash across the bridge to the cabin. Well, Master Hakuin, who's in our lineage Japanese Zen master, one of his practices was to sit in the graveyard and to challenge that kind of fear that would come up. He said the wolves used to come and lick his ears. So anyway, different strokes for different folks, but for us it's around a created container that is safe in us, for us to be able to let go of that kind of safety mind. And and this practice has a repetitiveness to it that means that the allows us to approach again and again the same stuff, and it's like that because the things that we need to work on are the things that are going to become apparent to us. They're the concerns and questions that arise again and again from our own particular makeup, our own particular kind of history, our own particular neuroses and strengths. And we keep it simple. We keep it simple with a really simple practice. And like I said, this practice involves every aspect of the day. So, especially when we sit, what we investigate and what we appreciate is whatever comes up. And we have our practice which is about letting go of the story, letting go of embellishing our lives, and That's great. But what also comes up are things that are, I guess, either uncomfortable or challenging or even just random stuff. And the practice is to stay with it, stay with this these kind of emotions and feelings and boredom or anger or jealousy or whatever comes up. And it's quite can be quite uncomfortable to sit with whatever it is. It could be frustration, but our practice is to stay with it. And I can't kind of emphasize that enough, but that really is what the it's like holding your feet to the fire. Is that that's the what this practice is about. And if you do that, you really start to feel the a shift. And it's quite and it can be quite challenging. It can be very challenging. Yeah, but that's where the real juice of the practice is in some ways it's hard to recognize it because we're so used to avoidance, to setting up things that will ameliorate discomfort. You know, you just have to. It's funny driving back after session, you see billboards on the side of the road or whatever, and you realize before you just kind of pass them by, and this one they seem to be directly talking to you, and they seem to be like, you know, you must buy this car and you will be happy. It's like, oh. It's almost like some of the artifice is stripped away. There's a when we recite the four vows in the evening and after Dharma talk, there's one line, the third one, which says the Dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. And another way of expressing this is that the Dharma gates are countless, and I vow to wake to them. And these dharmas just means it can mean teachings, it can mean things. So we're saying these things, this is boundless, and it's like all our experiences are boundless, countless, constant. And I vow to master them. Master's not a great word, but it's got that feeling of I vow to master means to gain a not a mastery over them, but to fully embody them and to not be used by them. And so you know, it says the sound of the tui, the sunlight that comes in through the window, the pain in the legs, the taste of the food, and all these are dharmas that are boundless. And so, and they're all there for us to practice with. You know? And how do we practice with them? We practice with them by just allowing them to fill us, allowing them to be us, because that's what they are. The Dharmas are us. We are none other than this arising. There's a lovely poem by a teacher called Tsung Po, who was a Chinese, I think he was a government official. You know, he practiced for many years and had a realization one night, and the next day he wrote a poem, and he said, he's out in the woods, kind of like we are today, and he said, I'm waking. He said, the form of the mountains, Buddha's body of bliss. The sound of the valley streams are his long golden tongue. Millions and billions of sutras since last night. How can I explain this to others? You know, it's kind of a beautiful poetic way of describing that those dharmas, that constant flowing of life that weaves through us. The form of the mountains are Buddha's body of bliss. So you look outside and the trees and the mountains, that's Buddha's body of bliss. But you know, it's like when you say Buddha, this is Buddha, this experience is Buddha, we are. and the sound of the valley streams go down to the river, and you hear the sound. And that's his long golden tongue. So that voice, that speaking. Millions and billions of sutras since last night. So every cry of the birds, every feel of the sunshine, every pain in the leg. And how can I explain this to others? Yeah, it's not about explanation, is it? You know, it's just what he's saying there. It's not, gee, I'm trying to work out a way. It's just, it's not explainable. You know, this is direct experience. As soon as you try and explain it, as soon as you create a story around it, around your experience, you're kind of secondary. So, you know, in Sesshin, we really set up this whole experience, this whole container to allow us to experience this body of bliss. And we don't settle for second best, you know, like conjecture, weighing things up, planning, regretting. Of course we do it, you know. But we really are setting ourselves up to really be able to deeply experience this moment-to-moment of life. And sometimes we really need to, this experience is sometimes quite, we don't quite want everything that we get. Sometimes it's good to kind of cultivate a feeling of love and kindness to this as well. You know, so that it's like a, you know, we've got a whole bunch of kind of emotions and beings within us, and some of them we're very happy to embrace, and other ones we're not. You know, and so when we bring awareness to this, we can kind of get a bit of a feel for that we like and that we don't. And the work is like with a, you know, like with a difficult child. It's to how to bring that emotion, that feeling into this awareness, this kind of this mother-like awareness. And we do this through practice, you know. So it's like you might say, well, I'm feeling frustrated. And it's a bit of a hint to ourselves in some ways. It's like, because that feeling of frustration, we've put it on the outside. You know, so, and when you hear that voice in yourself, then it gives you just a clue. You know, there's a that you're creating a kind of a story. And what a nice way to practice, or the way to practice, challenging it as it is to really swallow that kind of feeling, save its frustration, to swallow that. And what does swallowing it mean? Normally it means just, if you can locate the feeling around it, it's usually a physical sensation. It's some kind of non-verbal physical sensation, sometimes it's almost like psychic, whatever you want to call it, but non-verbal. And just to really be present with that. You know, it's like the you know, this practice, these dharmas are boundless, because they truly are. It's like, it's the gift that keeps on giving. You know, there's no there's kind of no gap. You know, and I think we were talking about before how rare it is to do this. You know, it's there are only a few. You know, you might see cat sitting on a wall in the sunshine, and that's what, not many of us are actually beings. Trees do it, you know, and rocks, and but human beings, it's very challenging for us to do this, just to sit and appreciate. And what did Woody Allen say? You know, showing up is 90%. So 90% is
showing up and getting it in on time.
Is that what he said? Yeah. Yes, so showing up showing up for your life. You know, because it doesn't occur anywhere else, you know, it's always like this. I was thinking about the aspects of constancy. When we recite the names of the Buddhas in the mornings, they call, all the way goes through from the past, what they call the past seven or the past six, really. I don't know whether they say past seven, but anyway, there's six Buddhas before you get to Shakyamuni, and Shakyamuni Butsu. And then, in that kind of constancy, what it really talks about is a stream of practice through from time immemorial, which is what the Buddhas before Shakyamuni are, through to the present day, and then of course, you know, going off until whenever. Ralph was talking during the introduction about his granddaughter and how that that seeing you know someone else coming through in that stream. And us practicing here gives you know his granddaughter the opportunity to practice, which is no mean thing. You know, it's quite a when you feel that those effects of that practice. You know, and that's that constancy, and this isn't about being a hare here. This is about, we're kind of like tortoises, really. You know, we kind of move slowly on down the track. Sometimes we go fast, sometimes it seems we go backwards, but it's really a practice of constancy and constantly returning. It's like a river that comes down this valley and wears away the mountains. You know, it's time. You know, I think about, Bernie Glassman, Tetsugan Roshi, who died recently, was Maizumi Roshi's first successor, and his gratitude for his long years of practice. You know, he started off with Maizumi Roshi in the early 60s, and was he's also an aeronautical engineer as well. He had a PhD, very bright, very energetic man, and was, because him and Maizumi Roshi basically were the drivers for establishing the Zen Center Los Angeles, and then, you know, in our lineage here, direct. And so Maizumi Roshi was my teacher's teacher, and then and Bernie was kind of the older brother, who started off quite formally as a Zen monk, and then ended up as a clown. It's kind of a nice arc of practice. And him and Jeff Bridges wrote a book together. It's called The Zen Master, The Dude and the Zen Master. Has everybody seen The Big Lebowski?
Yeah.
If you haven't, I watch it at least once a year or more. Dude, that's right. Because there's some expressions in there that are apparently very Zenish, like the dude abides. There's no one home, man. Yeah. So anyway, I kind of wrote a book about the dude and the Zen master. So, and I might just briefly touch on a koan, kind of talk a little bit about that. That practice of constancy. And this one is, I talked about Shakyamuni Buddha in the lineage, and this one is this koan, or this little story, is between Shakyamuni and his successor, Mahakashyapa, who because our lineage we recite in the Japanese form is Makakasho. So it goes Shakyamuni Butsu Daiyosho, Makakasho Daiyosho, Osho Makakasha. Is here, but in the Sanskrit or Pali, it's Mahakashyapa. So this is the case, the koan. It's So once in ancient times, when the world honored one was at Mount Gurukshetra, he twirled a flower before his assembled disciples. All were silent, only Mahakashyapa broke into a smile. The world honored one said, that's the Buddha, I have the eye treasury of right Dharma, the subtle mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, and the flawless gate of the teaching. It is not established upon words or phrases, it is a special transmission outside tradition. I now entrust this to Mahakashyapa. And there's a commentary here by Wu Min, who put this book of koans together. Goldface Gautama, that's the Buddha, insolently degrades noble people to commoners. He sells dog flesh under the sign of mutton and thinks it quite commendable. Suppose that all the monks had smiled, how would the eye treasury have been transmitted? Or suppose that Mahakashyapa had not smiled, how could he have been entrusted with it? If you say the eye treasury, that's the Dharma, can be transmitted, that would be as if the gold-faced old fellow was swindling people in a loud voice at the town gate. If you say the eye treasury cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha say that he had entrusted it to Mahakashyapa? And then Wu Min just gives a little verse. Twirling a flower, the snake shows its tail. Mahakashyapa breaks into a smile, and people and devas are confounded. It's interesting. So this koan, the stories between the world honored one, or Goldface Gautama, as they talk about him in here, and Mahakashyapa, who's one of his senior disciples. And so Mahakashyapa was a real ascetic, and he's very thin, apparently smelt very bad because he never washed. And but he was always sitting beside the Buddha. And so the story here is that they're giving a talk in at Mount Gurukshetra, which was Vulture Peak, which is where one of the Buddha's outdoor temples was, and a lot of people had turned up to listen to the talk. And so Mahakashyapa would have been sitting beside the Buddha, and then someone would have offered flowers. That's, you know, quite traditional in Asia, and there would have been a lot of flowers around, and everyone's sitting there silent waiting for the words of the Buddha, and then he picks up a flower and twirls it. And everybody is, I guess, you know, great, twirling a flower. And then Mahakashyapa smirks, or I think it's, as Akin Roshi says in here, like the translation there is like cracks his face, or cracks a smile. So it's like, you know, he might even roll his eyes slightly. I'm not sure. But, and then the world honored one, the Buddha, says, I have the eye treasury of right Dharma, the subtle mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, and the flawless gate of the teaching. It is not established upon words and phrases. It is a special transmission outside tradition or outside the teachings, outside the formal teachings. I now entrust this to Mahakashyapa. So in that Zen, this is a Zen story. It probably didn't occur because this was apparently wasn't written down until about 1000 AD, so 1500 years after the Buddha, this story emerges. I was reading another book yesterday. It's one of kind of using it as the base for the Four Noble Truths talk, and it's it's just saying that the Buddha didn't leave any successors, you know, in a sense of that formal transmission, but it's very much a kind of a Japanese or Chinese the whole lineage concept is very it's kind of very, I guess, East Asian, North Asian, Chinese, I guess, in terms of the Taoist and Confucian tradition about establishing legitimacy. And so this is kind of like a Zen story, but as Akin Roshi says in his commentary here, which is quite lovely, he says, look, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like when we're talking about true religious experience, what we're really talking is about this moment-to-moment unfolding of our lives. And we use myths and stories to support it. And so whether this happened or whether it didn't happen is not important. It's about I guess, the timeless archetype and the lessons and teachings that come out of this. So what happens here is you've got the Buddha, you know, twirling a flower, and that's part of the koan, is around that twirling the flower. What did Mahakashyapa see that nobody else saw? And so that's part of the koan. And I'm not going to go into that really, but Tenshin Roshi and Mizumi Roshi, Tenshin Roshi, my teacher, and Mizumi Roshi would say, the bit that's usually completely missed in this koan and in most commentaries is that the Mahakashyapa had been practicing with the Buddha for 40 years or so, and he says that's what's missed, you know, is that the this practicing together is one of the key aspects, and that enables Mahakashyapa to potentially roll his eyes and smirk, you know, because he knows the Buddha intimately, and you know, he knows what he's doing. He's always knows what he's doing, and that that aspect of constancy is really important, and that so that aspect of, you know, it's not just a one hit wonder, you know, we come and do session and then we're sorted, you know, it's that the something like spiritual practice is the trail or the track that we walk on, you know, so there is, you know, a transmission, an entrustment here, but that's just like a point in time. You know, and we are infinitely grateful and indebted unto the Buddha and Mahakashyapa and all the folks down through the ages who have maintained this, those that we don't know. You know, we also recite at the end of the lineage, you know, all those men and women whose names have been lost or forgotten. But that is our practice, you know, it's a really constant stream. So yeah, just to kind of round this out, so that you know, we've got at least two full days left, and you know, things, life will keep arising. You know, there's no stopping that. You know, again and again and again, you know, the conditions of our lives are presented to us, and you know, our work is to really invite them in. Yeah. And we invite them in by, yeah, letting go of that story, noticing the story. You know, so we were talking about yesterday about those Four Noble Truths, you know, that first one is almost like that noticing. You know, recognize me, see me. And then that letting go. When you recognize it, and then returning, which is that realization, and then cultivating, which is that constant nature. So yeah, it's not easy work, you know, it's a challenge, you know, but it's the rewards are tremendous.